So, thank you, Tom Dogger and Nikki Rizzo. Thank you very much for putting this session together. It's quite an honor for me to be standing here at APHA because I have a real strong conviction that we need more veterinarians who are doing public health all the time anyway, actually getting involved in the public health arena and helping us do this One Health talk. So thanks very much. We're working with the commission under the terms, the mission, the goals of Connect, Create, Educate, and we're trying to connect all the One Health stakeholders. Turns out they're around the world, so that we can create teams and working groups and activities that will help educate about One Health and One Health issues. So, a show of hands, probably since you're staying late after school to hear a One Health talk, you probably all know about One Health, right? Hands, show of hands? Yeah. Anybody in here who had never heard of One Health before they walked in today? Okay, so I'm preaching to the choir here a little bit, but I'm still going to use my teaching examples because they're fun. So it is a new professional imperative, and I heard you say that I might have a little more time. So I'm not going to rush like I thought I might have to. Ann Druin, who was actually Carl Sagan's third wife, I don't know if you follow Carl Sagan, his work, but she made this quote that I think is perfect about how so many of us believe that humans are the center of the universe and everything revolves around us, and well, guess what? We're just part of the continuum of nature. We're just another one of the mammals in the environment. And we obviously have some pretty major impacts on our environment as human beings, which can be quite unfortunate. It's very upsetting to me that our oceans are becoming cesspools and that there's data out there that there's a mass of garbage floating in our ocean the size of Rhode Island or something like that. So it's really pretty upsetting what we're doing, kind of in a non-cognizant way. This One Health call is kind of our wake-up call. It's kind of our ray of hope for the future because kind of the way we're going right now is unsustainable. So we're all working on that together. I like this slide because you can see the, can you see it? It's kind of dark. We need to lower the lights. But you can see the concentration of humanity across the globe because it's at night, and you can see where there are lights. So there may be a lot of humanity in sub-Saharan Africa where there's not a lot of lights, but you can see this. And the current data is that we're at about 7.23 billion people on the Earth, and you've all heard the estimate that we're going to 9 billion by 2050. Well, I think the World Bank recently said we're probably going to get there by 2043, and maybe we'll smooth out in our population explosion by 2062. But it puts a whole new twist on the whole idea of food security when you start thinking about having to feed this globe. And how are we going to do it? Are we going to do it with animal protein? Are we going to do it with plants? If we're going to do it with plants, we better be paying attention to the health of our soils and of plants and paying attention to the plant world too. So the commission's actually included plants in our mission statement, humans, animals, environment, and plants, because it was kind of being lumped into the environment and getting lost. So I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. I like to teach One Health by stories. Some of you may get this right away. The little guy, let's see, do I have a pointer? Yeah, this little guy right here, he's mine about 28 years ago. So I lived this One Health story. It was one of my early One Health experiences. He, at about 20 months of age, when he was just about thinking about potty training, he got this horrible diarrhea, and it went on for weeks. Pediatrician couldn't figure out what it was, said, oh, it's probably viral, don't worry about it, it'll go away. Well, 6 weeks later, my little boys had this diarrhea. It was extremely contagious. My husband and I both got it. We were so sick, we couldn't lift our heads off the pillow, taking turns getting up to take care of the sick baby. It was really horrible. So finally, after calling the pediatrician's office, and they just weren't alarmed, they weren't trying to figure out what was going on, I was like, oh my gosh, we're going to have to hospitalize my little boy. My eyes were sinking in his head. So we were both, my husband and I were both at the vet school at the time. I was doing my PhD and he was on faculty and he took a diaper into the vet school. Any idea what we found? Took it to the parasitologist vet school at NC State.
Giardia?
Good guess. Wasn't Giardia. What? C. diff? Another good guess. Wasn't C. diff? Wasn't amoeba. Oh, you guys are making good guesses though. Things that the pediatrician hadn't even talked about. So, Cryptosporidia, it lights up like a Christmas light, red, under an acid-fast stain. And so we call the pediatrician's office and say, he's got Cryptosporidia. We don't know exactly where he got it, but we In hindsight, we'd had company a week or so before. They had little children. We'd been in swimming pools with them, to the beach with them. They did mention that their kids had had diarrhea. They lived in a very rural setting. Could have picked it up, cattle and wildlife. We don't know where it came from, but it was a terrible experience. And the reason this is a One Health story to me is that that was in 1986. Maybe at that time this wasn't really on the radar for the human arena. I think now it would be, because this organism killed a lot of people with AIDS. Anybody who's immunocompromised, I've seen this jump up on the rule out list a lot more frequently now. But in 1986, it wasn't even on the radar, and neither were they even trying to help figure it out. And when I called the pediatrician's office and told them, you know, I'm a veterinarian, this is what we found, they acted like they'd never heard of it. So today, this hopefully would be diagnosed a lot more quickly, but it's just one of those examples. And this is an infectious disease, and One Health is about a whole lot more than infectious disease. But this is one example of an infectious disease that, if we'd been sharing information across these sectors, even in 1986, had there been an immune-compromised person in my home, somebody on chemotherapy, this could have been devastating. And, you know, there are a lot of lessons learned here. A couple more real quick stories. This one is true. Any veterinarians other than Dr. Delker and a few? Yeah, we've got veterinarians here. Marilyn's here. Do you know Robert Miller, the veterinary cartoonist? He does the Mind Over Miller in the Veterinary Medicine magazine. He wrote this story about his daughter. So I'm giving credit to this. That's not his daughter. That's an anonymous image. But she was a travel writer. She went down to South America, had a wonderful time, wrote her story, climbed volcanoes, you know, boated up the Amazon, went way back up in the Amazon, which my daughter's done. It's pretty scary when you know you can only find your daughter by getting on a boat and going up the Amazon. So she came home from her trip, and she had a wonderful time, and she was covered with bug bites. And a couple of weeks later, she gets sick, and she has really weird signs. Swollen, hot, painful, swollen joints, weird skin lesions, discolored fingernails, shortness of breath. Try to go to the diagnostics, get the doctors to figure out what was going on with her. 10 CT scans, you know, 2 years later, she's had 76 specialists and all these CT scans, and she's been tentatively diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The list has gone on. She ended up, because they thought that she had some granulosa-type tumors or masses on her intestinal tract, they thought she might have gastrointestinal stromal tumors, which, as you know, would be a type of cancer. So they scheduled her for exploratory surgery. Well, about that time, her dad became aware of Dr. Ed Breitswert's work at the Vector-Borne Disease Lab at NC State. So somehow they convinced her doctors to send the blood samples needed to look for that. They looked for organisms that might be vector-borne by PCR. And if any of you know Dr. Breitswert, you probably know what they found. Nobody knows. Ask the EID crowd, got this. They found Bartonella. And so that's a vector-borne disease, and it's just on the cusp right now of becoming, of emerging and the significance of it in the human population. We've known about it in animals, and the medical profession's known about it for cat scratch fever, trench fever during World War I. But we've always thought, well, that's in the animal realm. We don't have to worry about that in the human realm. Well, guess what? This information is emerging that it's a very significant pathogen for people. So once they got the diagnosis, for her, I mean, she did go into surgery because it is already scheduled by the time they got the results from Galaxy Diagnostics. Surgeon comes out and tells her dad, well, they didn't find any evidence of cancer. And her dad, Robert Miller, says, well, I didn't think she had cancer. I think she's got Bartonella. And the surgeon says, this is a direct quote, I'm a surgeon. I don't know what Bartonella's disease is. So my point here is that had there been this sharing of this information, and it's very emerging still right now, but had there been this sharing of information across our professions, think of the money that would have been saved. And 76 specialists and 10 CT scans and the anguish this young woman went through, had her radiologist or her surgeon or somebody along the way known, well, there's an organism that can cause this kind of granulomatous type lesion in the intestines. I wonder if she's got Bartonella. And so that's just my second One Health teaching story. I have a couple others for you. This one has to do with the environment. I came out of vet school in 1981. I'm going to age myself here. And I wasn't taught anything about hyperthyroid cats. And for a reason. Any of you veterinarians in the audience done any practice. You know, you can these days you can diagnose a hyperthyroid cat probably about once a week if you're in a busy practice. And it turns out it's usually the older cats. Well, in the 80s, guess what showed up in our environment that has been correlated to the appearance of hyperthyroid cats? Flame retardants, polybrominated diphenyl ethers. So this is a correlation. The studies are being done. They've actually found these PBDEs in the cats. This is it's a chemical that has been put in our carpets and our draperies and all our upholsteries and all our hard plastics, and the cats sit around on our computers or our TVs, and this stuff outgasses and it gets in the dust and it gets on the cat's fur, and the cat grooms all the time, so they think that there's a correlation there. Turns out there's a young woman at Duke University who has been also looking at it in children and has found it, unfortunately, higher levels in lower socioeconomic families, unfortunately. And it's been postulated now, and this is going to be real interesting to watch. It's been postulated that because these are endocrine disruptors in our environment, that they could have something to do not only with the Big Macs and all the overeating that our fast food chains do, but it could also have something to do with the obesity epidemic that we're seeing, especially in children. So just something to keep your eye on. That's very one health thing. The cats in this case were the sentinels for what we might be exposed to in our environment. And because of this work and some other awareness that came out about these flame retardants, they've actually outlawed the PBDEs in most, like especially in children's pajamas, but you're using something else now. So, this was my slide about Dr. Stapleton at Duke and what they were finding with children. So human-animal bond is a huge part of this One Health conversation. I love this slide, the antidepressant slide is just wonderful. I don't know if you guys can see the middle bottom one. Can you read that sign? Anybody read that? Chick infested area, good eyes. So think about our animals. We live in the same environment. We go into these areas. Our animals can get tick infested. They come and then they get in the bed with us. And that's what's happening a lot because of our close, one of the presentations today where that people think of their pets as their family members, and that's very true. I've experienced that a lot in practice. So the problem is we are in our silos. We're very much in our silos from human medicine, animal medicine, even among, in human medicine, we're in silos. And we're in our public health silo. The government agencies are very siloed. We're in silos that we cannot seem to be able to break out of. We don't go to each other's meetings. We don't read each other's continuing education meetings. We don't read each other's journals. In fact, if we wanted to, sometimes we can't read each other's journals because if you go online, you have to be a member of that organization to get access to those journal articles. So the systems are against us here. This is one of the challenges for our One Health work, is that some of these systems that have pushed us into these silos are our uphill struggles right now. So it was a wake-up call. It is a wake-up call. We've been talking about One Health now for 10 or 15 years, but it's a very old concept. We're just kind of resurrecting the need for our communication across species. Before we got to the point where we could look at this amino acid and this strand of DNA doing this, we were gotten so specialized, which is wonderful. We need the specialties, and we need what we've learned from it. We've lost that connection in the big picture, and that's what One Health is trying to bring us back to. This slide, it was shared by Billy Karish of EcoHealth Alliance, and I love this slide because as this One Health conversation has progressed, you can see that this work was done, I'm going to ask, early 2015? Is that when you guys actually compiled this data?
That's right, March.
March. So this slide was presented in March of 2015, and you can see that publications, articles coming out in the veterinary sciences look very high. Maybe I can use my pointer here. Very high. So, look down through here. There's occupational health, environmental sciences, infectious diseases, ecology. I'm really surprised that parasitology is out here because some of the biggest biggest One Health fans are parasitologists. But you get out here, we're missing the toxicologists and the anthropologists, the economists, the social scientists. All these professions need to be part of this One Health conversation. So that's a bit of our challenge. I don't know how that happened. So what are we going to do? What can we do? Most people, they hear about the One Health concept. Once they hear about it, they go, oh, yeah, we really need that. But nobody really knows what to do about it. And so people like Tom and Nick are trying to do exactly what we need to do. They're trying to create the opportunities, the forum, the mechanism for us to come together and talk about these things, to identify the issues that fall at the interface of our professions, and then try to overcome the challenges. So just from an academic standpoint, one of our major challenges is Academicians are not rewarded in the tenure process for interdisciplinary work. Think about it. If an academician works with a big team on a big interdisciplinary project, they may not be able to publish it in one of their really specialized journals. And if they don't publish in a really specialized journal, they're not going to get as many points toward tenure. It's just another one of those challenges that have been thrown up against our really being able to work across the sectors very easily. Some universities are doing this. Texas A&M University is doing this at the administrative level. UC Davis has a huge One Health program. I have a whole list of them that I'll show you here. But even our government agencies, we're having a terrible time talking across the agencies. We're trying very hard with the Global Health Security Agenda, which I just learned last week is way all about One Health. It's very exciting, and the next generation group that's coming out of that. In industry, there's proprietary knowledge, and they don't want to share things. That's just one of the ways it is. And in our environmental resources, think about your cell phone in your hand. Think about the minerals in it that are being mined and the destruction of our environment to mine those minerals. In fact, I had an eye-opening talk in North Carolina from a young veterinarian who's working with a company that in Madagascar is mining for these natural resources. And I said, how can you in good conscience work with this company that's destroying our earth and mining for these minerals? And she said, well, Cheryl, what are you holding in your hand? Our demand for these minerals for our cell phones, it's not going to go away. So we better look for companies that are trying to go about this in a very holistic and as environmentally friendly way as they can. So it kind of changed my thinking about this, because we're not going to give up our cell phones and our computers. Those resources have to come from somewhere. And this is just part of this interconnectedness, this network of what we're doing to our environment, how it's affecting the animals and the people. So there are challenges. We really need a place, a forum, a way, a mechanism to come together, and that's what we're trying to do with the One Health conversation. As I mentioned, there are a lot of, I call them hotspots or bubbles of One Health activity around the country and indeed around the world. This is just some of the academic settings that I know of that have handfuls of faculty that are really strongly advocating for One Health and working together, some more strongly than others. Georgetown University Medical Center, I'm very excited. They've just come under the commission. They're the first med school to come to the commission. The conversation is happening slowly but surely. If you could bring me some more med schools, I would love that. Or some schools of osteopathy, schools of nursing, that would be awesome. And North Carolina, Tennessee, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Mexico, and I just learned today that Arizona is doing this, and maybe you guys can tell me of others that are doing One Health at the state public health level. They're actually, Kentucky. Did I even get Kentucky on here? Oh my gosh, I left it off. Kentucky has some really good success stories about how they have been able to broker conversations between the Corps of Engineers and public health officials and entomologists, because when the Corps of Engineers raise water levels to a certain point, the mosquito population explodes and then they see spikes in EEE. So this is a conversation that's like, duh, this wasn't happening? Well, it wasn't. But their One Health conversation, they were able to make it happen. There's the One Health Initiative website team that is based out of Florida, but it's actually made up of five individuals. They have carried the mantra and educated about One Health now since about 2008, have been a huge grassroots support for One Health. There's a One Health Academy in Washington, D.C. It's been having pretty much monthly One Health discussions for years now. I think they started in 2007 or somewhere in there, 2008. And they ask speakers in to talk on One Health topics and get people from government agencies participate. So if you're in D.C., look it up. Other non-academic groups, other than the One Health Academy, the One Health Initiative, the North Carolina, I was able to work very closely with starting the North Carolina One Health Collaborative. And some of you are talking about doing this. Just reach out to people you think are interested and see if they'd like to start a discussion group, and then start asking speakers and putting out the word to other people you think might be interested. The next thing you know, you'll have a listserv and you'll have a collaborative One Health group going in your region. It's not hard to do, because people are thirsty for this. They really get it. Who did I not mention there? Oh, St. Louis Zoo does One Health activities. Animal Medical Center up in New York is all about One Health. They collaborate a lot with They have a medical school right there close by. And some of you may know Barbara Nederson Horowitz and the Zubiquity book that she wrote and the conferences that she's doing. So these are non-academic One Health groups. One of the things that the Commission's trying to start doing is for some of these groups, we're trying to offer webinar and GoToWebinar platforms so that they can, like the One Health Academy, we've done some of their speaker webinars so they can be available to a wider audience and get recorded if they want to and teach into the future. So those are things we're trying to do. I'm going to speed up a little bit here. This is some of the history. Some of you know about the One Health Tripartite, the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO-OIE, and the World Health Organization. In 2010, there was this meeting in Stone Mountain, and then the United Nations and the World Bank are all saying they're supporting One Health, European Union. So there's been a lot going on for a long time. There's International One Health Congress in 2011 in Melbourne, Australia. There was a second one in in Thailand. Then there was one, Thailand was in 2013. There was one just this year in Amsterdam that I was able to go to. There was also this year in Madrid in May, there was a joint World Medical Association, World Veterinary Association One Health meeting. It was pretty amazing, the people that showed up there. So the One Health Commission was actually created out of some work that was done by the One Health Initiative team in 2007-2008 that was kind of a joining of AMA and AVMA. So one of the bullet points of their executive summary was to create some organization to make it their business to create these opportunities for us to come together across the profession. So we're trying very hard. I've been telling some of you that I've talked to today, we're trying very hard to figure out who's doing what for One Health so we can connect hands, join hands, and do it a little bit better. So here's our Who's Who page. If you know of a group that's not listed on our page, please let us know. We did last November a first international Who's Who in One Health webinar. This thing ran for 8 hours because we were trying to get all the time zones around the world. We had speakers from all over the world. And I was amazed how many people stayed with us for 8 hours, so that there's that much interest out there globally. We have all these action teams that we're starting up. I won't go into all of them. Last February, there was a letter to the White House from 7 senators that a young man, Chase Crawford, was able to help teach the senator whose office he was working in a congressional fellowship about One Health. And they got 6 other senators and wrote a letter, and then the grassroots One Health community got together. AVMA wrote a supporting letter. APHA wrote a supporting letter. That was you, Tom, wasn't it? Was that you? Yeah, you guys got that supporting letter going. NAP got one going, and so the commission wrote one, and we went a little step further. We actually made some suggestions. Joe and Ellie at the USDA One Health office did. Good idea, Cheryl. So what do you want the White House to do? So we actually outlined 3 suggestions of how a One Health platform in the United States and a One Health platform at the state level and in the United Nations, what it could look like, and circulated it around the One Health community and got for a couple of weeks and got tons of signatures. So if you look at it on our website, you can see who all signed up. So that's a review of that, and we're just organizing students from One Health, and we've brought students from One Health on the board. I'm going to go real fast now because I'm taking up all the time. There's a new international One Health platform that's trying to create a coalition of One Health activities around the world. The Commission and the One Health Initiative are working together on that. I feel very strongly that we need to reframe growth, and we need to heal the past and live the present, and indeed we need to dream the future. This happens to be a slide of all the locations where there are vet schools and med schools both located at the same place. It should be so easy for them to get together and collaborate. But I'll make this point to everybody I talk to, collaborations don't just magically happen. They start with relationships. This is what was being mentioned a second ago. Start with relationships, and relationships don't magically fall out of the sky. They start when we get in a room, we meet each other, say, oh, you're working on that, I'm working on that. Well, we could do that together. So that's what this One Health conversation requires. I love this quote. Dolly Parton says, if you're going to dream, you better put some wings and feet and fingers and hands on those dreams. You can't just sit around and think about what you want to do. You got to go do it. So that's what we're all about, trying to make it happen. So we do need to dream the future. We need to get across our silos. One Health is very much a team sport. We're all in this, and it's from every walk of life that needs to be really need to make in this conversation happen, from DVMs and MDs to housewives and LA public and city planners and city governments. So it's really up to us. Those of us sitting in this room right now, we've got it. We understand it. There's a lot of people walking around this meeting who've never heard of One Health, and think when they did, which is what we're trying to do here, is create these conversations, they'll agree that we really need this, and it might even change the way they think about things. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of just being sure that everybody that needs to be at the table for all the wicked problems that we're facing, from antimicrobial resistance to domestic violence to a lot of things, fall under this umbrella. So it's really up to us, and I really appreciate your attention. I don't have time for questions right now.
Thank you so much. Maybe we can have one question. Before that, I really appreciate the way you presented it and showing the intersections which can happen from the very beginning. You showed how certain sicknesses were not being able to be diagnosed, and you had to go to a parasitologist and maybe from the veterinary department in order to get a valid diagnosis. But I studied 15 years ago at Rutgers University campus, where there was veterinary medicine, public health, and medicine. And we are students took classes in comparative anatomy, comparative physiology, and other classes, which I found were very, very helpful to see the continuum. What would you suggest would be some measures on a political level and on a more local level, where you could actually combine, innovate subjects for students to be reached out to the public health students, medical students, veterinary students, which have some intersection there?
On the medical and veterinary side, it's a curricular problem. Their curricula are already so crammed. They get, many of the med schools, they get maybe 4 hours, like 4 hours of lecture on zoonotic diseases. This question was asked to me at GAMC the other day about the only thing that we're going to be able to do, at least in the professional setting, where med schools and vet students are, is to, for the faculty to all totally get it about One Health and teach everything they're teaching in that vein of thinking. They can teach, they still have to teach what they're teaching, but if you talk about trying to cram a One Health course into an already accredited curriculum, it's not going to happen. But we can educate the faculty to do what they're doing in a more inclusive way and try to get out of silence. On other educational levels, this conversation is starting to happen at the undergraduate level. And I find that students are driving this. Students learn about this and get this. And sometimes they're teaching their faculty about it. When North Carolina created its interinstitutional One Health course, it's cross-listed between Duke, UNC, and NC State. And that the North Carolina Collaborative has been able to facilitate. Students would come to me all the time, that Haley actually called into some of those discussions. Students would come to me all the time saying, how do I have a career in One Health? Or I've never heard, I'm a graduate student, how come nobody's ever said anything like this to me? This is so important, I don't understand why I'm not hearing it at school. The faculty has got to learn, and the only way we're going to do that is to get out of our silos and reach out, you know, across the silos and make sure that we're having these conversations. One of the things the commission is trying to do is to start moving more into education even earlier, maybe reaching K-12. It's a challenge.
Maybe one more question.
Thank you.
Thank you.